Your Health is supported by the North Carolina Cancer Hospital, serving you with innovative research with unequaled care. UNC Healthcare is leading, teaching, caring.
News Talk 1360, WCHL, and UNC Family Medicine present Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Your Health, providing practical health-related news and information for our listeners. Dr. Goldstein and Dr. Page are both actively involved in patient care at UNC Family Medicine. Now, Your Health.
Welcome to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health, supported by UNC Healthcare. I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein.
And I'm Dr. Christy Page.
And on our show today, Christy, we're going to be talking with nationally recognized psychologist, author, and organizational consultant, Dr. Stephanie Covington, about addiction and trauma recovery and healing. Sounds like something that I think I personally am really interested in, and I expect a lot of our listeners.
Well, and I think people sometimes are misled in thinking that addiction is not as big of a problem as we realize, that, you know, a lot of people cover it up.
Well, and I think we'll be really talking about also about the particular effects among women, and something that maybe the same treatments that are there for men may not be the exact same treatments women should have. So mm-hmm. I look forward to this conversation.
Me too. First, we've got some research that matters, Adam. We're going to be talking about bladder tests before surgery. Mm-hmm. Vitamins E and C and its relationship with vision.
Macular degeneration.
About even people at higher genetic heart risk, whether or not lifestyle makes a difference.
And I'm the poster child for some of that.
And also about the number of teenagers who misuse prescription painkillers.
Well, let's dive right in, literally, and look at this study that was in the New England Journal of Medicine, Christy, about incontinence or leakage of urine, which is a really common problem, and the types of studies that people have to do before they have surgery.
So this looked at 630 volunteers at 11 different medical centers of patients who were having urinary incontinence and were having sort of big workups of bladder tests of to see if there's urine leaking during filling of the bladder and other tests to sort of confirm the diagnosis before having surgery.
And so if these women came into the office and they leaked when they had a full bladder, they took half of them and they had them do the kind of traditional workup they would have done before surgery. And the other half, they offered surgery. And they looked at what happened 12 months later after surgery. And they found that surgery was successful in about 3/4 of both different groups. Those who had the additional testing didn't actually have better outcomes.
And I think this really hits both on the cost of care, that we're doing a lot of these tests that really are not guiding the surgeons and or the urologists in making difference, not changing their decision to do surgery or not, and really offering little information, and also not improving outcomes. So it's uncomfortable to the patient, it costs more money, and it falls into the category of more testing isn't necessarily better.
Right. I think, you know, this doesn't mean that these tests don't have a place and a purpose at the right time, because, you know, whether you can measure how you void when you do the urine or the pressure inside the bladder. But the reality is you may not need them, and you should have a conversation with your doctor if you're having incontinence or urinary leakage and you think you might need to have surgery about whether you really do need those tests or not.
I agree. Well, let's talk about vitamins used to guard against macular degeneration.
Well, first off, what is macular degeneration, Christy? Because that sounds like a big term, but it also sounds like something scary.
Well, it's one of the leading causes of vision loss in older adults. I mean, it's really profound and much more common than people realize.
Yes, 7 million people have macular degeneration, and close to 1 million have advanced disease. And I know a surgeon who had to quit doing his urologic surgery because of this macular degeneration, where you kind of have these holes mm-hmm. in the macula, which is kind of your central vision. You might see that peripheral vision, but you can't really see right in front of you as well as you should be able to. It's
makes
kind of scary.
It hard to see the details, and it yep. is scary because it tends to get worse. So there have been a lot of studies looking to see if antioxidants in the diet lead to lower risk of having macular degeneration. And this was looking at vitamin E in men and also vitamin C, comparing taking 400 international units of vitamin E versus placebo and taking 500 milligrams of vitamin C versus a placebo.
And 14,000 U.S. male doctors, these were in people like myself, who were given one versus the other in both of these. And unfortunately, neither of the vitamins had any protective effect against vision disorder. It was the same in both groups, indicating, you know, probably shouldn't be recommending these vitamins for many things. We haven't really come up with any good reasons that we've covered, mainly, Christy, but certainly not to protect against macular degeneration.
Yeah, we need to keep looking into what will protect against it, but that's not the answer. Okay, let's do our next one. This is about folks who have, by their genetics, just by their family history, higher risk for heart disease if you've had a father or a parent who's had a heart attack before the age of 55.
Yes, this was in the American Journal of Cardiology, Christy. And, you know, for instance, my father, who's no longer living, had a heart condition at an earlier age. So I certainly have increased risk of heart disease because of that family history. But I've adopted a really pretty good lifestyle in terms of being vegetarian and exercising. So I would be in this group, higher family risk, but lower risk for my lifestyle. And the question is, Have I reduced or eliminated my genetic risk? What would this study say?
Well, the study would pat you on the back and say you've done a good job. The healthy habits they studied were included not smoking, which I would assume you do not smoke considering
not
your
today.
Research. exercising regularly, check, you do that. And keeping a normal weight and then drinking alcohol only in moderation.
And I do that only in moderation. And I guess the question was, did I eliminate my risk? And the short answer is, well, no. I did improve my risk profile according to this because they followed 20,000 U.S. Male doctors and looked at over the two decades how many of the men suffered a heart attack. And certainly a slightly greater number of those who had this genetic risk factor did. It was definitely improved, though, when you adopted a lifestyle intervention. So I kind of like this, which is, you know, you got your genes, but you also got the environment, and you can control one of those, too.
Yep. I mean, it really, this is common sense, but it's nice when we have research to say that, yes, those decisions that you make really do affect your overall health.
Yep. And speaking of this last one that affects your overall health, this is some research that was in the Archives of Pediatrics and Adolescent Medicine about teenagers' use of painkillers. This is a very scary topic.
Very scary. They did a survey of behaviors and attitudes to about 7,400 high school seniors, 2007 through 2009. And these were public schools, private schools, 135 different schools. And they found out that about 13% said that they had ever used prescription painkillers for non-medical reasons, such as just to get high, to relieve pain, but where they were doing it not because of what they were prescribed for.
So maybe they got these from their parents' cabinets or maybe from friends. This suggests that there's a huge kind of subculture out there of inappropriate use of painkillers and by a group that may not really appreciate the dangers of these medicines.
And, I mean, the folks who used more of the painkillers or misused them were more likely to smoke pot, smoke cigarettes, to binge drink. So sort of a higher risk-taking population anyway.
Of addiction, similar to, we're going to be talking about this today with our guest, and suggesting with these teens that perhaps they get addicted and don't really know it, and this could lead to all kinds of problems.
Well, and also that they took up, I mean, the folks who continued on to take painkillers and have problems with it, that they're starting it at age 16 or 17. This has larger implications to their long-term health should they continue to misuse
Bottom
drugs.
Line, if you've got painkillers in your house for any reason,
lock them up.
Please, well, count your pills. Count your pills on a monthly basis, and if you don't need them anymore, get rid of them. How do you like that advice?
Good advice. Hard to do, but good advice.
Well, okay. That'll conclude the research that matters. We are going to take a short break. When we return, we'll be talking with Dr. Stephanie Covington about addiction and trauma, recovery and healing. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Golsey and Dr. Christy Page. UNC Family Medicine's number 2 ranked national program is rapidly transforming healthcare through excellence in teaching, clinical care, and research. To participate in UNC Family Medicine's efforts to move innovative ideas into action, call 843-5112 or email yourhealth@unc.edu.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on News Talk 1360 WCHL, sponsored by UNC Family Medicine. And now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Today on Conversations, Adam and I will be talking with nationally recognized psychologist, author, and organizational consultant, Dr. Stephanie Covington, about addiction and trauma, recovery, and healing. We are so glad to have you with us, Dr. Covington.
Well, I'm delighted to be online with you.
Dr. Covington, help Your Health listeners understand a little bit more about how you really became interested in this whole field of addiction medicine, but also about trauma. How did you get interested?
Well, a number of years ago, actually in the early 80s, I began seeing, I was working with many women who were having difficulties with alcohol and other drugs, and I began to see a pattern that most of them also had a trauma history. And so I started not only treating women for both trauma and addiction, but also writing papers and talking about this and trying to provide attention to this linkage.
And how did you approach starting to tease out that relationship between addiction and past trauma?
Well, what I could see, or what it looked like to me, is many women were using alcohol or other drugs as a coping mechanism, that they very often had actually had multiple instances of trauma, often beginning in childhood and then subsequently in their adult lives, sometimes also in their adolescence. And one of the ways they coped with it was to try to numb themselves out with alcohol or other drugs. And I felt that if this was true, then I couldn't just focus on an abstinence-based model of reducing their substance abuse, I'd also have to be working on the trauma.
And when we're talking about trauma, explain to us and for our listeners more about what you mean by that trauma in childhood.
Well, trauma, the definition of trauma varies a little bit, but it's an event, a threatening event that someone experiences that totally overwhelms their capacity to cope physically and or psychologically. And it can be physical abuse, it can be emotional abuse, it can be sexual abuse, it can be frightening medical procedures, it can be robberies and muggings, and even actually the experience of immigrating to this country could be traumatic. So there are many ways that trauma can manifest in people's lives. And for women, men and women are both at risk for trauma. Women are more at risk of the interpersonal violence than men are.
Well, I know you've written a great deal on this, and I know one of the things you wrote about is this whole process of women and addiction and being gender responsive. You know, it suggests perhaps that there are different things at play in men and women in this whole element of addiction. Help us understand how that, you know, where does it start?
Well, first, to me, gender actually means the difference between the experience of growing up male and growing up female. And so we see difference in people's lives if they're born male or female. And then when we begin to look at addiction, we can see that physiologically women's bodies are impacted differently than men's bodies when they use alcohol and other drugs. We can see that society treats them differently. Some of the common words used with alcoholic women is slut, bad mother, things we don't necessarily say about men who have a problem with alcohol. And so when you think about the realities of the lives of women and girls, you begin to see that maybe you have to develop interventions that are different than the way you might be working with men and boys.
And was this sort of revolutionary or a different way of thinking, that treating addiction for all comers, men, women, is really not the best approach, but individualizing it to the person and their gender and their situation makes the most sense? Was that a newer concept? It sounds like you've really been someone who's really forwarded this field.
Well, this has been something I've really sort of advocated for a long time. It actually really started at the end of the 60s and the 70s during the women's movement, when women came together in consciousness-raising groups and talked about the realities of their lives. And that's when we actually, as a society, began to hear about domestic violence, childhood sexual abuse, and we heard about addiction, women abusing alcohol and other drugs. And then there was a real push to get services for women. And that was about the same time that I was starting my career in in the end of the 70s, early 80s, and it was an idea. It was exactly what I was seeing in my private practice, and so I've just been one of the advocates for this model and have tried to get more and more people to look at this.
You know, we're talking with Dr. Stephanie Covington about addiction and trauma recovery and healing. And I wonder, Dr. Covington, you know, you talk about, or we think about frequently about violence in perhaps physical terms, in terms of, you know, domestic violence, but there's this large emotional component and sexual violence and psychological. Can you think of any recent examples or kind of cases from your experience that help us really see in concrete terms how some of what you're talking about plays out on the individual level?
Well, sure. Let me share with you about a young woman who had been physically abused in her family. And as she moved into her, and she'd had one, she was a form of sexual abuse, wasn't incest, but she had been inappropriately touched by a family member as a child. And when she became a teenager and started dating, she became very anxious if there was anything sexual. And so she began to use alcohol, and the boys that she was dating, they were happy to give her alcohol. And that made it possible for her to be more comfortable both in social situations and in any sexual situation. And by the time I met her, she was in her early 30s, and she was totally addicted to alcohol. It had started as a coping mechanism. And to work with her, it became really important not just to use a traditional abstinence-based model, now you need to stop using alcohol, but we also had to look at the trauma history in her life. She really had a lot of anxiety. It was connected to her abuse as a child. She felt the physical abuse was more impactful on her. However, I would say this experience with a family member also had an impact, because I think that's what really initiated her alcohol use to begin with. So here's an example that if a traditional provider of services was not looking at trauma and was not dealing with sexual issues, this young woman would be at high risk for relapse. It would be difficult for her to become abstinent unless these multiple issues were being worked on at the same time.
And is that a common scenario where you've got a person or a young person who's using, starting the alcohol or other substances primarily as a coping mechanism, and then it becomes an addiction?
Yes, this is very common. I mean, when we start looking at the statistics, for women who are in treatment, depending on where they are and how people define abuse, we often find between 60 and 90% of women who are abusing substances have a trauma history, have an experience of either emotional, physical, or sexual abuse, in usually beginning in childhood, although they very seldom have just one experience. There's usually multiple experiences over time. I think it'd be also, let me point out one of the differences between male and female substance abusers and trauma, because we also know that many men who are abusing substances have also experienced traumatic events. But the difference is when we look over the lifespan. So we have girls and boys both at risk for physical and sexual abuse as children, and particularly at risk from people they know. In adolescence, a boy's greatest risk for abuse happens if he's a gay young man or a young man of color, and then his risk actually comes from the police or his peers, from people who dislike him, or if he's a gang member from oppositional gang. But for a girl in her adolescence, her greatest risk for harm comes from her relationships, from the person to whom she's saying, I love you. And in adult life, a man's greatest risk for harm actually comes by being a victim of crime committed by a stranger. But the woman in her adult life is, again, at high risk for abuse in her relationship.
All so I can say is, wow.
So yeah. Many layers of complexity
And we're going to want to talk about this whole process then of really how you build in recovery and healing. But I think just hearing what you're saying opens up to so many questions I know we want to get into.
We do need to take a short break, but when we come back, we will continue talking with our guest, Dr. Stephanie Covington, about the connection between addiction and trauma. We'll be right back with Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Your Health is supported by UNC Health Sciences Library and NC Health Info, working together to connect people everywhere with knowledge to improve health. Visit nchealthinfo.org for answers you can trust.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on WCHL. And now, back to the show.
Welcome back. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. We're talking with psychologist and renowned author, Dr. Stephanie Covington, about addiction and trauma recovery and healing. And right before the break, Dr. Covington, I think you laid out really an impressive reason and rationale for the differences and why an approach to women that have addiction and trauma needs to be entertained. And I guess one of the fundamental questions here is this loss of trust in relationship building. And how do you go about dealing with that therapeutically, and how important is that to a sense of recovery?
Well, the trust issue is huge, obviously, particularly for one's experiences. If you get close to someone, you get harmed, and they're not going to want to trust anyone. And so part of how we do this is one way is if we can do some of the interventions in a group situation where the women see they're not alone, and you build on some of the common themes in their lives. You also need to have people who are doing counseling who are very reliable and trustworthy and show up when they say they're going to be there and are consistent and can deal with some of the inconsistencies that often happen when someone's in recovery. So they're, you know, it's a multiple-pronged approach, really. But it really is about that therapeutic alliance or that connection between the person who's seeking help and the person providing assistance.
And is it most helpful to have those groups be among women of the same gender with similar experiences or to have a therapist who's of the same gender that is a woman? Is it easier to have trust build and to work through some of those things among same gender, or is it okay to mix it?
Yes, what we have found is that when we can put women in groups together and have them facilitated by a woman, that really facilitates the trust process and helps with, as I said, building connections. So the different curricula that I've written, the different interventions I've designed, are designed to be led by women and for women to be in women's groups. And sometimes people say, well, what if she was abused by a female? And even it's not about the sex of the perpetrator, it's really about the commonalities that women can experience and the feeling of connection you can create in the group that's very important.
Well, I want to talk about one particular thing you mentioned before in that case you brought up, which was kind of alterations in sexuality that started at a very young age and now are maintained in part with substance use. And I know you've written on this element of kind of recovering a healthy sexuality. Tell us a little bit about how this occurs, maybe in that case or in others. What did you do and how does it work?
Well, one of the things that's really critical here for this woman, and not uncommon for many women actually, is what we call state-dependent learning, meaning they've never had a sexual encounter unless there was some mood-altering substance. And so what you have to do is help people have some other ways to cope and deal with anxiety and levels of discomfort that doesn't include alcohol and other drugs. So we teach them certain ways of breathing, for example, ways of staying more conscious and aware. We do body image work because often women have issues around their bodies and don't feel comfortable in their bodies. The other thing we know about trauma is it's numbing. It numbs people psychologically as well as physically. So we do exercises that have to do with sensation and women getting back in touch with their senses with some really simple exercises where in a brown paper bag, the group facilitator would have a lot of different objects like a cotton ball, an emery board, a rose petal, a seashell. And it sounds very simple, but women touching these things and beginning to sense and have feeling in their bodies again becomes very important to this whole healing process.
Well, it sounds like all of these things would be important steps to recovering from the trauma and coping with life and moving on. And it sounds like you've really found this true in patients suffering from addiction and having trouble getting past that, that the focus really has to be on this earlier trauma work. How have you, through your time, sort of made that connection? Are these the people who already have addiction, who need treatment for that, and then you're putting them all together in these groups? Or are, could it be sort of a mix of some with addiction, some with trauma?
Well, usually the groups are run, at this point in time, I'm not personally running groups, and I'm not doing clinical work, but different programs use these materials. Sometimes it's a substance abuse treatment program, sometimes it's a mental health clinic, and they put women together with certain shared things. They don't have to share everything. So you could have a group of women, for example, in a mental health setting who could be doing some of these group activities where some of them the primary issue is addiction, and another group of women the primary issue might be trauma. And for it just depends. People, because I've tried to write things that really deal with women's issues in a kind of generic way, women who are struggling with mental health issues often find help with many of these same exercises. So you don't have to.
It doesn't have to be that narrow.
So specific. The most important thing is that they first be all women.
Mm-hmm. Well, you've written about a woman's way through 12 steps, and I'm wondering if what's the difference between how we might think of the normal 12-step program and your women's way through 12 steps. I think that would be helpful.
Sure. Well. And how the first, there's several pieces in that, in the program material. There's a small book, and then there's a workbook, and then there's a facilitator guide. There's a DVD. We even have an app for it. But in the small book, what it is, it's women's stories who've recovered in various 12-step groups, because all the basic literature in 12 steps have nothing but male pronouns.
Right, because this is the traditional AA model of recovery, that a lot of that data is probably was on men.
Exactly. And the language and the materials is all male. And so many women have trouble relating to it, and the examples are all male. So I went around the country and interviewed women who'd recovered in 12-step programs and then wrote a little book keeping the language of the steps just the way it's written, but having women talk about their experiences, what the steps mean to them, and how they use them. And then we have a workbook that women can use for working the steps. And then the facilitator guide is for running groups for women using very simple art projects and interactive exercises. So you can teach women or girls what is the concept or what is the meaning of the steps so they can understand them through a creative endeavor, if you will, or, as I said, experiential exercises.
Nice.
And the other thing that's the difference for women, I think we have to realize, is for some women who are trauma survivors, going to a 12-step meeting could feel frightening.
Considering all of these resources that you've developed and the research that you've done, now I'm struck by many of our listeners out there may have a loved one or they themselves be struggling with addiction or struggling with an impact from trauma in their earlier life. Where do you think is a good place for someone to start, someone listening to our program who may want to know more?
I think that if you're struggling and you need to know more or you want to talk to someone to kind of find out, you can actually look in your community for Alcoholics Anonymous or Narcotics Anonymous. You can go to a 12-step meeting. They're free. Or you can Google in your community drug and alcohol information, and you will find that there are agencies free in your community that can help you to determine if indeed you have a problem and what kind of help you might need. Some people, going to a 12-step meeting is sufficient help. Other people, they need a professional who's involved in their life, either a therapist, or we have outpatient and inpatient treatment programs.
They could also Google Dr. Stephanie Covington and read some of your work.
Well, that's true. I think there's a website.
You're a little too modest to mention that, but I think we can toot your horn a little bit as an expert nationally and going around the country training professionals. That's a good resource.
Well, thank you. We've got the website has a lot of books and a lot of articles and information and a variety of things on it.
Well, Dr. Covington, thank you for taking time to be with us, and thank you for the work that you've done to help people across our nation.
Well, thank you, Christine Adam, for the invitation.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
We're going to take a short break, but when we return, we'll be right back with House Calls. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on News Talk 1360 WCHL, sponsored by UNC Family Medicine. And now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back to Your Health. For the House Call segment of our show today, Adam and I are going to spend a few minutes talking about your health questions and your concerns.
And if you have a question you'd like us to address on an upcoming show, we're going to have to do that one over.
I'm like, at first I thought you were hula dancing, and then I'm like, he's doing something else.
No, I was just playing, but
okay, well,
I lost. Okay, let's
button.
Go back. Okay.
All right.
Welcome back to Your Health. For the House Call segment of our show today, we're going to spend a few minutes talking about your health questions and concerns.
And if you have a question you want us to address, we want you to send your comments to yourhealth@unc.edu. Adam, we've got some good house calls today about snoring and fibromyalgia.
Yeah, I don't know if we're going to disclose on that one.
And about hyperthyroidism and also about colonoscopies. So let's get started.
Yep, let's listen to our very first house call.
I have had bad snoring for years. I was overweight and my internist told me to lose weight, that this might improve the snoring. I've lost 10 pounds over the last 2 months and the snoring is 50% better. I have 15 more pounds to go, but is there good evidence that snoring comes from too much weight?
Well, this is some good news here to start out house calls with. You've lost some weight. That's great news.
And your snoring is about 50% better. Those are both good things. I think the question that you're asking about snoring, or sometimes that's related to something called sleep apnea, which it can be a bigger problem that's related to snoring, is linked to obesity for sure.
And certainly, what's one of the first treatments, Christy, we recommend for people with sleep apnea?
To lose weight.
Lose weight. That's right. Because you can go on that BiPAP machine, and you know, which helps out, but it doesn't cure it, versus losing weight may cure some of that sleep apnea. So for you, we don't know if you had sleep apnea or not, but you certainly had that bad snoring. And, you know, the treatments for snoring, you know, a lot of them are kind of surgical, or some of these little bridging
things you put across your nose,
like physical devices. And the track record for those isn't great for most of them.
Or if you're my husband, I just keep elbowing until he turns over. That helps.
Sometimes you send them to the other room, or you have to go to the other room, and that's not what we recommend.
No.
Either. And even there's one where I've seen, Christy, where you inject into the tonsil or fossa, the soft palate of the mouth, you inject something and cause all that tissue to die and scar, and somehow that makes it better too. Doesn't sound like a really great therapy.
So we can't promise that losing the weight will solve all of it, because sometimes snoring comes from other things, but it is largely related to that. It's great news that you've gotten better by losing weight, and we want to encourage you to finish out that last 15 pounds.
Let us know how it works. Let's listen to our very next house call.
My muscles hurt all the time. My doctor looked at my medicines for asthma and reflux, but said they do not cause this. He checked my blood work and it's okay as well. Do I have fibromyalgia? If so, what is the best treatment?
Your doctor's looked at medicines for asthma and reflux. What's going on here, Christy?
Well, I think it sounds like your doctor did a good thing by looking. Medicines can be a cause for muscles hurting and aching. But it's usually pretty complex to try to figure out why people have achy bodies, and it could be fibromyalgia as one possibility.
Yeah, you know, a lot of times we think, and do people have a low potassium level that sometimes can be linked to some of these medications.
Or statins can make your muscles hurt sometimes.
Right, we call them for cholesterol. But for most people, those aren't the real reasons. And then we think about, well, could your muscle enzymes be elevated, like you have a rare disease like myositis, which is not frequent? So we look for those things too, but we don't usually find it.
And what is fibromyalgia? It is, you know, a complex sort of syndrome of pain where people get pain throughout their body. Often there are these trigger points in different muscle groups that hurt when you press on them. And it's complex. It can affect people's sleep. It can be also tied with mood or depression. And there's not sort of a quick pill that makes it all better, unfortunately.
Yeah, though I do remember, Christy, there's been a lot of research on this area. And when I was going through my medical training in the 17th century, that this was one of those things that people didn't believe was out there, you know. And nowadays, it's diagnosis, and I think all doctors believe in it. We may have a difficult time figuring out exactly what to do because it requires a kind of a team approach.
It does. And I mean, I truly believe this is a real thing. I have many patients with this syndrome who have, you know, really suffer from it. But the good news is that people can get better, but it does take a team approach. It takes exercise. It takes physical therapy. It sometimes takes medication.
I think we did some research that matters a few months ago about Tai Chi and fibromyalgia.
That's
so
true.
A meditative approach.
And some thinking of coping strategies, sometimes counseling or therapy. There can be lots of different and usually require lots of different pieces of this to sort of tease it out and try to make headway. But a good relationship with a doctor can make a good difference.
And if they don't believe you, we might suggest you see someone different.
I would agree with that.
Let's go to our very next house call.
I have hyperthyroidism, and I want to know if it's safe to take Tapazole for the treatment of it for long periods of time. The option of surgery or radiation seems worse to me. I would appreciate your thoughts.
Tapazole versus surgery versus radiation, those are big questions if you're thinking about the risks and the benefits of each one.
And, you know, with hyperthyroidism, when your thyroid is kind of overcharged, you really do need to shut that down a little bit, or else you have all kinds of adverse bad side effects. And this medicine called Tapazole, or otherwise known as methimazole, another brand and generic name for it, does shut down the thyroid.
I would want you to have a conversation with your endocrinologist or doctor about what the cause for the hyperthyroidism is and any particular recommendations about surgery or radiation versus the medicine. But a lot of this is about your personal preference, your willingness to take medication. And it's worth asking, most people, if they've had surgery, are going to have to take a different kind of thyroid medication because of having the thyroid removed.
And sometimes the thyroid burns out this hyperthyroidism, and naturally you become hypothyroidism and have to take a replacement. But I've had patients, Christy, that have been on this Tapazole for years. They really don't want to take the radiation. They don't want the surgery because they're scared of the consequences, and they don't mind taking the pill. So it certainly is doable. I do think talking either with an endocrinologist or your primary care doctor, really come up with a plan that works for you, because any of these can work.
What would you do, Adam, if there were equal options presented to you?
Now you're putting me on the line and making me kind of declare, Christy. I probably would go with the surgery or the radioactive iodide, because I think just taking a replacement and having it be too low is easier to manage than chronically taking a pill. And sometimes the side effects of the pills, like Tapazole, does have side effects. It can suppress your immune system.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess I wouldn't want to take that. I don't know. What about you?
I think I would try the Tapazole or the methimazole for a while and see how bad the side effects were and how hard it was to manage before I went to the other. But
we've made this crystal clear.
Exactly.
Thank you so much for your question. Let's listen to our very last house call.
I know everyone is telling me all the time to get a colonoscopy, and I am 55, but no one in my family has had colon cancer. I would like to get a stool test for blood every year instead. Is that okay?
Okay. We're going to be more people telling you it is time to get your colonoscopy. This test is a really good screening test to help prevent cancer, partly because it can detect those polyps before they even become cancer. And so if you are at all willing to get this thing done, I recommend it. But now we'll talk about the stool test.
Well, on the other hand, Christy, she doesn't really want to get the colonoscopy. You know, I don't really know why, but, you know, it's okay. I would probably encourage it too. But you know what? Stool fecal, a blood test to test for blood in the stool, while it's not perfect, is a screening test. And again, in the 17th century, it's what, you know, when I was in medical school, and even you as well, and it's still even today, is recommended as a possibility.
It's absolutely better than nothing. And
but you're supposed to have three of them, not just a single
three of them
one.
Every
you get
year.
Three of them every year.
So
lots of false positives.
Yeah, lots of false positives. And if you had a cancer that was causing bleeding, it's probably already a cancer versus catching it earlier. Colonoscopy is better, but if you're not willing, go with the stool test.
Well, Christy, that'll conclude our house calls. We've had a chance to talk about options to colonoscopy, including fecal occult blood testing.
To talk about tapazole versus radiation versus surgery for high thyroid.
Fibromyalgia, when your muscles hurt, is a possibility.
And about snoring and losing weight. Thank you for your house calls and for joining us today for Your Health. We hope we've addressed some issues and concerns that are important to you, and we want you to share your questions at yourhealth@unc.edu. Visit us online at yourhealthradio.org. Follow us on Twitter, Facebook, iTunes, and on our new health app.
Yep, just search for Your Health, one word, and get a free download. We'd like to thank the staff at WCHL, UNC Family Medicine, UNC Healthcare for their sponsorship, and our guest today, Dr. Stephanie Covington.
On behalf of Your Health, I'm Dr. Christy Page.
And I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein.
We will look forward to talking with you again next week. Take care.
The purpose of Your Health Radio is to educate listeners on healthcare issues. Listeners should always discuss their own health or medical concerns with their personal physician or other healthcare provider. Your Health is not a substitute for medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page has been brought to you by UNC Family Medicine for the Chapel Hill Carborough community. You can hear Your Health on Saturdays at 9 a.m., Sundays at 9 and 5, and Mondays at 6 and 10 p.m. Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of UNC Family Medicine and News Talk 1360, WCHL.